Unlike Doris, Selden did not know how to handle the blades, but he knew the Dalites would scarcely be aware of that. Doris said, "Just keep them off, Harry. Don't attack yet. Merrin, my next stroke will not be a scratch." Merrin, totally enraged, roared incoherently and charged blindly, attempting by sheer kinetic energy to overwhelm his opponent. Doris, dipping and sidestepping, ducked under his right arm, kicked her foot against his right ankle, and down he crashed, his knife flying. She then knelt, placed one blade against the back of his neck and the other against his throat, and said, "Yield." With another yell, Merrin struck out against her with one arm, pushed her to one side, then scrambled to his feet. He had not yet stood up completely when she was upon him, one knife slashing downward and hacking away a section of his mustache. This time, he yowled like a large animal in agony, clapping his hand to his face. When he drew it away, it was dripping blood. Doris shouted, "It won't grow again, Merrin. Some of the lip went with it. Attack once more, and you're dead meat." She waited, but Merrin had had enough. He stumbled away, moaning, leaving a trail of blood. Doris turned toward the others. The two that Selden had knocked down were still lying there, unarmed and not anxious to get up. She bent down, cut their belts with one of her knives, and then slit their trousers. "This way you'll have to hold your pants up when you walk," she said. She stared at the seven men still on their feet, who were watching her with awestruck fascination. "And which of you threw the knife?" There was silence. She said, "It doesn't matter to me. Come one at a time or all together. But each time I slash, someone dies." And with one accord, the seven turned and scurried away. Doris lifted her eyebrows and said to Selden, "This time at least, Hummin can't complain that I failed to protect you." Selden said, "I still can't believe what I saw. I didn't know you could do anything like that, or talk like that either." Doris merely smiled. "You have your talents, too. We make a good pair. Here, retract your knife blades and put them into your pouch. I think the news will spread with enormous speed, and we can get out of Billybottom without fear of being stopped." She was quite right. Undercover. The Van. In the unsettled times marking the final centuries of the First Galactic Empire, the typical sources of unrest arose from the fact that political and military leaders jockeyed for supreme power, a supremacy that grew more worthless with each decade. Only rarely was there anything that could be called a popular movement prior to the advent of psychohistory. In this connection, one intriguing example involves Davan, of whom little is actually known, but who may have met with Harry Selden at one time when... Encyclopedia Galactica. 72. Both Harry Selden and Doris Van Ebbele had taken rather lingering baths, making use of the somewhat primitive facilities available to them in the Tissalver household. They had changed their clothing and were in Selden's room when Gerard Tissalver returned in the evening. His signal at the door was, or seemed, rather timid. The buzz did not last long. Selden opened the door and said pleasantly, "Good evening, Master Tissalver, and mistress." She was standing right behind her husband, forehead puckered into a puzzled frown. Tissalver said tentatively, as though he was unsure of the situation, "Are you and Mistress Van Ebbele both well?" He nodded his head as though trying to elicit an affirmative by body language. Quite well. In and out of Billybottom without trouble, and we're all washed and changed. There's no smell left. Selden lifted his chin as he said it, smiling, tossing the sentence over to Salver's shoulder to his wife. She sniffed loudly, as though testing the matter. Still tentatively, DeSalver said, "I understand there was a knife fight." Selden raised his eyebrows. "Is that the story?" "You and the mistress against 100 thugs, we were told, and you killed them all. Is that so?" There was the reluctant sound of deep respect in his voice. "Absolutely not," Doris put in with sudden annoyance. "That's ridiculous. What do you think we are, mass murderers? And do you think 100 thugs would remain in place, waiting the considerable time it would take me, us, to kill them all? I mean, think about it." "That's what they're saying," said Cecilia Tisalver with shrill firmness. "We can't have that sort of thing in this house." "In the first place," said Selden, "it wasn't in this house. In the second, it wasn't 100 men, it was 10. In the third, no one was killed. There was some altercation back and forth, after which they left and made way for us."
"They just made way? Do you expect me to believe that, Outworlders?"
demanded Mistress DeSalver belligerently. Selden sighed. At the slightest stress, human beings seem to divide themselves into antagonistic groups. He said, "Well, I grant you one of them was cut a little. Not seriously."
"And you weren't hurt at all?" said DeSalver.
The admiration in his voice was more marked. "Not a scratch," said Selden. "Mistress Venabili handles 2 knives excellently well."
"I dare say,"
said Mistress DeSalver, her eyes dropping to Dora's belt.
"And that's not what I want to have going on here."
Doris said sternly, "As long as no one attacks us here, that's what you won't have here."
"But on account of you," said Mistress DeSalver, "we have trash from the street standing at the doorway."
"My love," said DeSalver soothingly, "let us not anger."
"Why?"
spat his wife with contempt.
"Are you afraid of her knives? I would like to see her use them here."
"I have no intention of using them here," said Doris, with a sniff as loud as any that Mistress DeSalver had produced. "What is this trash from the street you're talking about?" DeSalver said, "What my wife means is that an urchin from Billybottom, at least judging by his appearance, wishes to see you. And we are not accustomed to that sort of thing in this neighborhood. It undermines our standing." He sounded apologetic. Selden said, "Well, Master DeSalver, we'll go outside, find out what it's all about, and send him on his business as quickly." "No, wait," said Doris, annoyed. "These are our rooms. We pay for them. We decide who visits us and who does not. If there is a young man outside from Billybottom, he is nonetheless a Dalite. More important, he's a Trantorian. Still more important, he's a citizen of the Empire and a human being. Most important, by asking to see us, he becomes our guest. Therefore, we invite him in to see us." Mistress DeSalver didn't move. DeSalver himself seemed uncertain. Doris said, "Since you say I killed 100 bullies in Billybottom, you surely do not think I am afraid of a boy, or for that matter of you two." Her right hand dropped casually to her belt. DeSalver said with sudden energy, "Mistress Venabili, we do not intend to offend you. Of course these rooms are yours, and you can entertain whomever you wish here." He stepped back, pulling his indignant wife with him, undergoing a burst of resolution for which he might conceivably have to pay afterward. Doris looked after them sternly. Selden smiled dryly. How unlike you, Doris. I thought I was the one who quixotically got into trouble, and that you were the calm and practical one whose only aim was to prevent trouble. Doris shook her head. I can't bear to hear a human being spoken of with contempt just because of his group identification, even by other human beings. It's these respectable people here who create those hooligans out there. It's these respectable people here who create those hooligans out there. And other respectable people, said Selden, who create these respectable people. These mutual animosities are as much a part of humanity. Then you'll have to deal with it in your psychohistory, won't you? Most certainly, if there is ever a psychohistory with which to deal with anything at all. Ah, here comes the urchin under discussion, and it's Rach, which somehow doesn't surprise me. 73. Rach entered, looking about, clearly intimidated. The forefinger of his right hand reached for his upper lip, as though wondering when he would begin to feel the first downy hairs there. He turned to the clearly outraged Mistress DeSalver and bowed clumsily.
Thank you, missus. You got a lovely place.
Then, as the door slammed behind him, he turned to Selden and Doris with an air of easy connoisseurship.
Nice place, guys.
I'm glad you like it, said Selden solemnly. How did you know we were here?
Followed you. How'd you think? Hey, lady,
he turned to Doris.
You don't fight like no dame.
Have you watched many dames fight? Asked Doris, amused. Rach rubbed his nose.
No, never seen none whatever. They don't carry knives, except little ones to scare kids with. Never scared me.
I'm sure they didn't. What do you do to make dames draw their knives?
Nothing. You just kid around a little. You holler, hey, lady, let me...
He thought about it for a moment and said,
Nothing.
Doris said, Well, don't try that on me.
You kidding? After what you did to Marin? Hey, lady, where'd you learn to fight that way?
On my own world.
Could you teach me?
Is that what you came here to see me about?
Actually, no. I came to bring you a kind of message.
From someone who wants to fight me?
No one wants to fight you, lady. Listen, lady, you got a reputation now. Everybody knows you. You just walk down anywhere in old Billy Button, and all the guys will step aside and let you pass, and grin, and make sure they don't look cross-eyed at you. Oh, lady, you got it made. That's why he wants to see you.
Selden said, Rach, just exactly who wants to see us?
Guy called Devan.
And who is he?
Just a guy. He lives in Belly Button and don't carry no knife.
And he stays alive, Rach?
He reads a lot, and he helps the guys there when they get in trouble with the government. They kind of leave him alone. He don't need no knife.
Why didn't he come himself, then? Said Doris. Why did he send you?
He don't like this place. He says it makes him sick. He says all the people here, they lick the government's...
He paused, looked dubiously at the two outworlders, and said,
Anyway, he won't come here. He said they'd let me in 'cause I was only a kid.
He grinned.
They almost didn't, did they? I mean, that lady there who looked like she was smelling something?
He stopped suddenly, abashed, and looked down at himself.
You don't get much chance to wash where I come from.
It's all right, said Doris, smiling. Where are we supposed to meet, then, if he won't come here?
After all, if you don't mind, we don't feel like going to Billy Button.
I told you, said Rach indignantly. You got free run of Billy Button, I swear. Besides, where he lives, no one will bother you.
Where is it? Asked Selden.
I can take you there. It ain't far.
And why does he want to see us? Asked Doris.
Dunno, but he says like this.
Rach half closed his eyes in an effort to remember.
Tell them I want to see the man who talked to a Dalite heatsinker like he was a human being, and the woman who beat Marin with knives and didn't kill him when she might have done so. I think I got it right.
Selden smiled. I think you did. Is he ready for us now?
He's waiting.
Then we'll come with you. He looked at Doris with a trace of doubt in his eyes. She said,
All right, I'm willing. Perhaps it won't be a trap of some sort. Hope springs eternal.
74. There was a pleasant glow to the evening light when they emerged, a faint violet touch and a pinkish edge to the simulated sunset clouds that were scudding along. Dahl might have complaints of their treatment by the imperial rulers of Trentor, but surely there was nothing wrong with the weather the computers spun out for them. Doris said in a low voice, We seem to be celebrities, no mistake about that. Selden brought his eyes down from the supposed sky and was immediately aware of a fair-sized crowd around the apartment house in which the Tisalvers lived. Everyone in the crowd stared at them intently. When it was clear that the two outworlders had become aware of the attention, a low murmur ran through the crowd, which seemed to be on the point of breaking out into applause. Doris said,
Now I can see where Mistress Tisalver would find this annoying. I should have been a little more sympathetic.
The crowd was, for the most part, poorly dressed, and it was not hard to guess that many of the people were from Billy Button. On impulse, Selden smiled and raised one hand in a mild greeting that was met with applause. One voice, lost in the safe anonymity of the crowd, called out, Can the lady show us some knife tricks? When Doris called back, No, I only draw in anger, there was instant laughter. One man stepped forward. He was clearly not from Billy Button, and bore no obvious mark of being a Dalite. He had only a small mustache, for one thing, and it was brown, not black. He said, Marlo Tanto of the Trantorian HV News. Can we have you in focus for a bit of our nightly holocast?
No, said Doris shortly. No interviews.
The newsman did not budge. I understand you were in a fight with a great many men in Billy Button, and won. He smiled. That's news, that is.
No, said Doris. We met some men in Billy Button, talked to them, and then moved on. That's all there is to it, and that's all you're going to get.
What's your name? You don't sound like a Trantorian.
I have no name.
And your friend's name?
He has no name.
The newsman looked annoyed. Look, lady, you're news, and I'm just trying to do my job. Rach pulled at Dora's sleeve. She leaned down and listened to his earnest whisper. She nodded and straightened up again.
I don't think you're a newsman, Mr. Tanto. What I think you are is an imperial agent trying to make trouble for Dahl. There was no fight, and you're trying to manufacture news concerning one as a way of justifying an imperial expedition into Billy Button. I wouldn't stay here if I were you. I don't think you're very popular with these people.
The crowd had begun to mutter at Dor's first words. They grew louder now and began to drift, slowly and in a menacing way, in the direction of Tanto. He looked nervously around and began to move away. Doris raised her voice.
Let him go. Don't anyone touch him. Don't give him any excuse to report violence.
And they parted before him.
Rach said, Aw, lady, you should've let them rough him up.
Bloodthirsty boy, said Doris. Take us to this friend of yours.
75. They met the man who called himself Devan in a room behind a dilapidated diner, far behind. Rach led the way, once more showing himself as much at home in the burrows of Billybottom as a mole would be in tunnels underground in Helicon. It was Doris Van Ebele whose caution first manifested itself. She stopped and said,
Come back, Rach. Exactly where are we going?
To Devan, said Rach, looking exasperated. I told you.
But this is a deserted area. There's no one living here.
Doris looked about with obvious distaste. The surroundings were lifeless, and what light panels there were did not glow, or did so only dimly.
It's the way Devan likes it, said Rach. He's always changing around, staying here, staying there. You know, changing around.
Why? Demanded Doris.
It's safer, lady.
From whom?
From the government.
Why would the government want Devan?
I don't know, lady. Tell you what. I'll tell you where he is and tell you how to go, and you go on alone, if you don't want me to take you.
Selden said, No, Rach, I'm pretty sure we'll get lost without you. In fact, you had better wait till we're through so you can lead us back.
Rach said at once,
What's in it for me? You expect me to hang around when I get hungry?
You hang around and get hungry, Rach, and I'll buy you a big dinner. Anything you like.
You say that now, mister. How do I know?
Doris' hand flashed, and it was holding a knife, blade exposed.
You're not calling us liars, are you, Rach?
Rach's eyes opened wide. He did not seem frightened by the threat. He said,
Hey, I didn't see that. Do it again.
I'll do it afterward, if you're still here. Otherwise,
Doris glared at him,
we'll track you down.
Aw, lady, come on, said Rach. You ain't gonna track me down. You ain't that kind. But I'll be here.
He struck a pose.
You got my word.
And he led them onward in silence, though the sound of their shoes was hollow in the empty corridors. Devan looked up when they entered, a wild look that softened when he saw Rach. He gestured quickly toward the two others, questioningly.
Rach said, These are the guys.
And grinning, he left. Selden said, I am Harry Selden. The young lady is Doris Van Ebele. He regarded Devan curiously. Devan was swarthy and had the thick black mustache of the Dalite male. But in addition, he had a stubble of beard. He was the first Dalite whom Selden had seen who had not been meticulously shaven. Even the bullies of Billybottom had been smooth of cheek and chin. Selden said, What is your name, sir?
Devan. Rach must have told you.
Your second name?
I am only Devan. Were you followed here, Master Selden?
No, I'm sure we weren't. If we had, then by sound or sight, I expect Rach would have known. And if he had not, Mistress Van Ebele would have.
Doris smiled slightly. You have faith in me, Harry.
More all the time, he said thoughtfully. Devan stirred uneasily.
Yet you've already been found.
Found?
Yes. I have heard of this supposed newsman.
Already? Selden looked faintly surprised.
but I suspect he really was a newsman, and harmless. We called him an Imperial agent at Rach's suggestion, which was a good idea. The surrounding crowd grew threatening, and we got rid of him.
No, said Devan, he was what you called him. My people know the man, and he does work for the Empire. But then you do not do as I do. You do not use a false name and change your place of abode. You go under your own names, making no effort to remain undercover. You are Harry Seldon, the mathematician.
Yes, I am, said Seldon. Why should I invent a false name?
The Empire wants you, does it not?
Seldon shrugged. I stay in places where the Empire cannot reach out to take me.
Not openly. But the Empire doesn't have to work openly. I would urge you to disappear. Really disappear.
Like you? As you say, said Seldon, looking about with an edge of distaste. The room was as dead as the corridors he had walked through. It was musty through and through, and it was overwhelmingly depressing.
Yes, said Devan, you could be useful to us.
In what way?
You talked to a young man named Hugo Amaryll.
Yes, I did.
Amaryll tells me that you can predict the future.
Seldon sighed heavily. He was tired of standing in this empty room. Devan was sitting on a cushion, and there were other cushions available, but they did not look clean. Nor did he wish to lean against the mildew-streaked wall. He said, "Either you misunderstood Amaryll, or Amaryll misunderstood me. What I have done is to prove that it is possible to choose starting conditions from which historical forecasting does not descend into chaotic conditions, but can become predictable within limits. However, what those starting conditions might be, I do not know, nor am I sure that those conditions can be found by any one person, or by any number of people, in a finite length of time. Do you understand me?
No.
Seldon sighed again. Then let me try once more. It is possible to predict the future, but it may be impossible to find out how to take advantage of that possibility. Do you understand?
Devan looked at Seldon darkly, then at Doors. Then you can't predict the future.
Now you have the point, Master Devan.
Just call me Devan, but you may be able to learn to predict the future someday.
That is conceivable.
Then that's why the Empire wants you.
No.
Seldon raised his finger didactically. It's my idea that that is why the Empire is not making an overwhelming effort to get me. They might like to have me if I can be picked up without trouble, but they know that right now I know nothing, and that it is therefore not worth upsetting the delicate peace of Trantor by interfering with the local rights of this sector or that. That's the reason I can move about under my own name with reasonable security. For a moment, Devan buried his head in his hands and muttered, "This is madness." Then he looked up wearily and said to Doors, "Are you Master Seldon's wife?" Doris said calmly, "I am his friend and protector."
"How well do you know him?"
"We have been together for some months."
"No more?"
"No more."
"Would it be your opinion he is speaking the truth?"
"I know he is, but what reason would you have to trust me if you do not trust him? If Harry is for some reason lying to you, might I not be lying to you equally in order to support him?"
Devan looked from one to the other helplessly. Then he said, "Would you in any case help us?"
"Who are us, and in what way do you need help?"
Devan said, "You see the situation here in Dahl. We are oppressed. You must know that.
and from your treatment of Hugo Emeril, I cannot believe you lack sympathy for us.
We are fully sympathetic.
And you must know the source of the oppression.
You are going to tell me that it's the imperial government, I suppose, and I dare say it plays its part. On the other hand, I notice that there is a middle class in Dahl that despises the heatsinkers, and a criminal class that terrorizes the rest of the sector.
Devan's lips tightened, but he remained unmoved. Quite true, quite true. But the Empire encourages it as a matter of principle. Dahl has the potential for making serious trouble. If the heatsinkers should go on strike, Trantor would experience a severe energy shortage almost at once, with all that that implies. However, Dahl's own upper classes will spend money to hire the hoodlums of Billybutton and of other places to fight the heatsinkers and break the strike. It has happened before. The Empire allows some Dahlites to prosper, comparatively, in order to convert them into imperialist lackeys, while it refuses to enforce the arms control laws effectively enough to weaken the criminal element. The imperial government does this everywhere, and not in Dahl alone. They can't exert force to impose their will, as in the old days, when they ruled with brutal directness. Nowadays, Trantor has grown so complex and so easily disturbed that the imperial forces must keep their hands off. A form of degeneration, said Selden, remembering Hummond's complaints.
What? Said Devan.
Nothing, said Selden. Go on.
The imperial forces must keep their hands off, but they find that they can do much even so. Each sector is encouraged to be suspicious of its neighbors. Within each sector, economic and social classes are encouraged to wage a kind of war with each other. The result is that all over Trantor, it is impossible for the people to take united action. Everywhere, the people would rather fight each other than make a common stand against the central tyranny, and the Empire rules without having to exert force.
And what, said Doris, do you think can be done about it?
I've been trying for years to build a feeling of solidarity among the peoples of Trantor.
I can only suppose, said Selden dryly, that you are finding this an impossibly difficult and largely thankless task.
You suppose correctly, said Devan. But the party is growing stronger. Many of our knifers are coming to the realization that knives are best when they are not used on each other. Those who attacked you in the corridors of Billybutton are examples of the unconverted. However, those who support you now, who are ready to defend you against the agent you thought was a newsman, are my people. I live here among them. It is not an attractive way of life, but I am safe here. We have adherents in neighboring sectors, and we spread daily.
But where do we come in? Asked Doris.
For one thing, said Devan, both of you are outworlders, scholars. We need people like you among our leaders. Our greatest strength is drawn from the poor and the uneducated because they suffer the most, but they can lead the least. A person like one of you two is worth 100 of them.
That's an odd estimate from someone who wishes to rescue the oppressed, said Selden.
I don't mean as people, said Devan hastily. I mean as far as leadership is concerned. The party must have among its leaders men and women of intellectual power.
People like us, you mean, are needed to give your party a veneer of respectability.
Devan said, You can always put something noble in a sneering fashion if you try. But you, Master Selden, are more than respectable, more than intellectual. Even if you won't admit to being able to penetrate the mists of the future.
Please, Devan, said Selden, don't be poetic and don't use the conditional. It's not a matter of admitting. I can't foresee the future. Those are not mists that block the view, but chrome steel barriers.
Let me finish. Even if you can't actually predict with, what do you call it, psychohistorical accuracy, you've studied history, and you may have a certain intuitive feeling for consequences. Now, isn't that so?
Selden shook his head.
I may have a certain intuitive understanding for mathematical likelihood, but how far I can translate that into anything of historical significance is quite uncertain. Actually, I have not studied history. I wish I had. I feel the loss keenly.
Doris said evenly,
I am the historian, Devan, and I can say a few things if you wish.
Please do, said Devan, making it half a courtesy, half a challenge.
For one thing, there have been many revolutions in galactic history that have overthrown tyrannies, sometimes on individual planets, sometimes in groups of them, occasionally in the Empire itself,
or in the pre-imperial regional governments.
Often this has only meant a change in tyranny. In other words, one ruling class is replaced by another, sometimes by one that is more efficient and therefore still more capable of maintaining itself, while the poor and downtrodden remain poor and downtrodden, or become even worse off.
Devan, listening intently, said, I'm aware of that. We all are. Perhaps we can learn from the past and know better what to avoid. Besides, the tyranny that now exists is actual. That which may exist in the future is merely potential. If we are always to draw back from change with the thought that the change may be for the worse, then there is no hope at all of ever escaping injustice.
Doris said, A second point you must remember is that even if you have right on your side, even if justice thunders condemnation, it is usually the tyranny in existence that has the balance of force on its side. There is nothing your knife handlers can do in the way of rioting and demonstrating that will have any permanent effect, as long as, in the extremity, there is an army equipped with kinetic, chemical, and neurological weapons that is willing to use them against your people. You can get all the downtrodden, and even all the respectables on your side, but you must somehow win over the security forces and the imperial army, or at least seriously weaken their loyalty to the rulers.
Devan said, Trantor is a multi-governmental world. Each sector has its own rulers, and some of them are themselves anti-imperial. If we can have a strong sector on our side, that would change the situation, would it not? We would then not be merely ragamuffins fighting with knives and stones.
Does that mean you do have a strong sector on your side, or merely that it is your ambition to have one?
Devan was silent.
Doris said, I shall assume that you are thinking of the mayor of Y. If the mayor is in the mood to make use of popular discontent as a way of improving the chance of toppling the emperor, doesn't it strike you that the end the mayor would have in view would be that of succeeding to the imperial throne? Why should the mayor risk his present, not inconsiderable, position for anything less? Merely for the blessings of justice and the decent treatment of people concerning whom he can have little interest?
You mean, said Devan, that any powerful leader who is willing to help us may then betray us.
It is a situation that is all too common in galactic history.
If we are ready for that, might we not betray him?
You mean, make use of him, and then at some crucial moment subvert the leader of his forces, or a leader at any rate, and have him assassinated?
Not perhaps exactly like that, but some way of getting rid of him might exist if that should prove necessary.
Then we have a revolutionary movement in which the principal players must be ready to betray each other, with each simply waiting for the opportunity. It sounds like a recipe for chaos.
You will not help us then, said Devan.
Selden, who had been listening to the exchange between Devan and Doors with a puzzled frown on his face, said,
"We can't put it that simply. We would like to help you. We are on your side. It seems to me that no sane man wants to uphold an imperial system that maintains itself by fostering mutual hatred and suspicions. Even when it seems to work, it can only be described as metastable. That is, as too apt to fall into instability in one direction or another. But the question is, how can we help? If I had psychohistory, if I could tell what is most likely to happen, or if I could tell what action of a number of alternative possibilities is most likely to bring on an apparently happy consequence, then I would put my abilities at your disposal. But I don't have it. I can help you best by trying to develop psychohistory."
"And how long will that take?"
Selden shrugged. "I cannot say."
"How can you ask us to wait indefinitely?"
"What alternative do I have, since I am useless to you as I am? But I will say this. I have, until very recently, been quite convinced that the development of psychohistory was absolutely impossible. Now I am not so certain of that."
"You mean you have a solution in mind?"
"No. Merely an intuitive feeling that a solution might be possible. I have not been able to pin down what has occurred to make me have that feeling. It may be an illusion, but I am trying. Let me continue to try. Perhaps we will meet again."
"Or perhaps," said Devan, "if you return to where you are now staying, you will eventually find yourself in an imperial trap. You may think that the Empire will leave you alone while you struggle with psychohistory, but I am certain the Emperor and his toady Demerzel are in no mood to wait forever any more than I am."
"It will do them no good to hasten," said Selden calmly, "since I am not on their side as I am on yours. Come, Doors." They turned and left Devan, sitting alone in his squalid room, and found Rach waiting for them outside. 76. Rach was eating, licking his fingers, and crumpling the bag in which the food, whatever it was, had been. A strong smell of onions pervaded the air, different somehow, yeast-based perhaps. Doris, retreating a little from the odor, said,
"Where did you get the food from, Rach?"
"Devan's guys. They brought it to me. Devan's okay." "Then we don't have to buy you dinner, do we?" said Selden, conscious of his own empty stomach.
"You owe me something,"
said Rach, looking greedily in Doris' direction.
"How about the lady's knife, one of them?"
"No knife," said Doors.
"You get us back safely, and I'll give you 5 credits.
"Can't get no knife for 5 credits, grumbled Rach.
"You're not getting anything but 5 credits, said Doors.
"You're a lousy dame, lady,"
said Rach.
"I'm a lousy dame with a quick knife, Rach, so get moving." "All right, don't get all perspired."
Rach waved his hand.
"This way."
It was back through the empty corridors. But this time, Doors, looking this way and that, stopped.
"Hold on, Rach. We're being followed."
Rach looked exasperated.
"You ain't supposed to hear 'em."
Selden said, bending his head to one side, "I don't hear anything."
"I do," said Doors. "Now, Rach, I don't want any fooling around. You tell me right now what's going on, or I'll wrap your head so that you won't see straight for a week. I mean it."
Rach held up one arm defensively.
"You try it, you lousy dame. You try it. It's Devan's guys. They're just taking care of us in case any knifers come along."
"Devan's guys?"
"Yeah. They're going along the service corridors."
Dor's right hand shot out and seized Rach by the scruff of his upper garment.
She lifted, and he dangled, shouting, "Hey, lady! Hey!"
Selden said, "Dors, don't be hard on him."
"I'll be harder still if I think he's lying. You're my charge, Harry, not he."
"I'm not lying," said Rach, struggling. "I'm not."
"I'm sure he isn't," said Selden. "Well, we'll see. Rach, tell them to come out where we can see them." She let him drop and dusted her hands.
"You're some kind of nut, lady," said Rach aggrievedly.
Then he raised his voice.
"Yay, Devan, come out here, some of you guys."
There was a wait, and then from an unlit opening along the corridor, two dark-mustached men came out, one with a scar running the length of his cheek. Each held the sheath of a knife in his hand, blade withdrawn.
"How many more of you are there?" asked Dors harshly.
"A few," said one of the newcomers. "Orders. We're guarding you. Devan wants you safe."
"Thank you. Try to be even quieter. Rach, keep on moving."
Rach said sulkily,
"You roughed me up when I was telling the truth."
"You're right," said Dors. "At least, I think you're right, and I apologize."
"I'm not sure I should accept," said Rach, trying to stand tall. "But all right, just this once."
He moved on. When they reached the walkway, the unseen corps of guards vanished. At least, even Dor's keen ears could hear them no more. By now, though, they were moving into the respectable part of the sector. Dors said thoughtfully,
"I don't think we have clothes that would fit you, Rach."
Rach said,
"Why do you want clothes to fit me, missus?"
Respectability seemed to invade Rach once they were out of the corridors.
"I got clothes."
"I thought you'd like to come into our place and take a bath."
Rach said,
"What for? I'll wash one of these days, and I'll put on my other shirt."
He looked up at Dors shrewdly.
"You're sorry you roughed me up, right? You trying to make up?"
Dors smiled.
"Yes, sort of."
Rach waved a hand in lordly fashion.
"That's all right. You didn't hurt. Listen, you're strong for a lady. You lifted me up like I was nothing."
"I was annoyed, Rach. I have to be concerned about Master Selden."
"You're sort of his bodyguard?"
Rach looked at Selden inquiringly.
"You got a lady for a bodyguard?"
"I can't help it," said Selden, smiling wryly. "She insists, and she certainly knows her job."
Dors said,
"Think again, Rach. Are you sure you won't have a bath? A nice, warm bath?"
Rach said,
"I got no chance. You think that lady is gonna let me in the house again?"
Dors looked up and saw Cecilia DeSalver outside the front door of the apartment complex, staring first at the outworld woman and then at the slum-bred boy. It would have been impossible to tell in which case her expression was angrier.
Rach said,
"Well, so long, Mr. and Mrs. I don't know if she'll let either of you in the house."
He placed his hands in his pocket and swaggered off in a fine affectation of carefree indifference. Selden said,
"Good evening, Mistress DeSalver. It's rather late, isn't it?"
"It's very late," she replied. "There was a near riot today outside this very complex because of that newsman you pushed the street vermin at."
"We didn't push anyone on anyone," said Dors.
"I was there,"
said Mistress DeSalver intransigently.
"I saw it."
She stepped aside to let them enter, but delayed long enough to make her reluctance quite plain.
She acts as though that was the last straw, said Doris, as she and Selden made their way up to their rooms.
So, what can she do about it? Asked Selden.
I wonder, said Doris.
Officers. Rach. According to Harry Selden, the original meeting with Rach was entirely accidental. He was simply a gutter urchin from whom Selden had asked directions. But his life from that moment on continued to be intertwined with that of the great mathematician until... Encyclopedia Galactica. 77. The next morning, dressed from the waist down, having washed and shaved, Selden knocked on the door that led to Doris' adjoining room, and said in a moderate voice, "Open the door, Doris." She did. The short reddish-gold curls of her hair were still wet, and she, too, was dressed only from the waist down. Selden stepped back in embarrassed alarm. Doris looked down at the swell of her breasts indifferently, and wrapped a towel around her head.
"What is it?" she asked.
Selden said, looking off to his right, "I was going to ask you about why." Doris said very naturally, "About why? In connection with what? And for goodness sake, don't make me talk to your ear. Surely you're not a virgin." Selden said in a hurt tone, "I was merely trying to be polite. If you don't mind, I certainly don't. And it's not why about what. I'm asking about the why sector."
"Why do you want to know? Or, if you prefer, why?
"Look, Doris, I'm serious. Every once in a while, the Y sector is mentioned. The mayor of Y, actually. Hummin mentioned him. You did. Devan did. I don't know anything about either the sector or the mayor."
"I'm not a native Trantorian either, Harry. I know very little, but you're welcome to what I do know. Y is near the South Pole. Quite large. Very populous."
"Very populous at the South Pole?"
"We're not on Helicon, Harry, or on Cinna either. This is Trantor. Everything is underground, and underground at the poles or underground at the equator is pretty much the same. Of course, I imagine they keep their day-night arrangements rather extreme, long days in their summer, long nights in their winter, almost as it would be on the surface. The extremes are just affectation. They're proud of being polar."
"But upperside they must be cold indeed."
"Oh, yes. The Y upperside is snow and ice, but it doesn't lie as thickly there as you might think. If it did, it might crush the dome. But it doesn't, and that is the basic reason for Y's power."
She turned to her mirror, removed the towel from her head, and threw the dry net over her hair, which in a matter of 5 seconds gave it a pleasant sheen. She said,
"You have no idea how glad I am not to be wearing a skin cap," as she put on the upper portion of her clothing.
"What has the ice layer to do with Y's power?"
"Think about it. 40 billion people use a great deal of power, and every calorie of it eventually degenerates into heat and has to be gotten rid of. It's piped to the poles, particularly to the South Pole, which is the more developed of the two, and is discharged into space. It melts most of the ice in the process, and I'm sure that accounts for Trantor's clouds and rains, no matter how much the meteorology boggins insist that things are more complicated than that."
"Does Y make use of the power before discharging it?"
"They may, for all I know. I haven't the slightest idea, by the way, as to the technology involved in discharging the heat, but I'm talking about political power. If Dahl were to stop producing usable energy, that would certainly inconvenience Trantor.
But there are other sectors that produce energy and can up their production, and of course there is stored energy in one form or another. If Dahl were to stop producing usable energy, that would certainly inconvenience Trantor, but there are other sectors that produce energy and can up their production, and of course there is stored energy in one form or another. Eventually, Dahl would have to be dealt with, but there would be time. Why, on the other hand?
Yes?
Well, Y gets rid of at least 90% of all the heat developed on Trantor, and there is no substitute. If Y were to shut down its heat emission, the temperature would start going up all over Trantor.
In Y, too.
Ah, but since Y is at the South Pole, it can arrange an influx of cold air. It wouldn't do much good, but Y would last longer than the rest of Trantor. The point is, then, that Y is a very touchy problem for the Emperor, and the mayor of Y is, or at least can be, extremely powerful.
And what kind of a person is the present mayor of Y?
That I don't know. What I've occasionally heard would make it seem that he is very old and pretty much a recluse, but hard as a hypership hull, and still cleverly maneuvering for power.
Why, I wonder? If he's that old, he couldn't hold the power for long.
Who knows, Harry? A lifelong obsession, I suppose. Or else it's the game, the maneuvering for power, without any real longing for the power itself. Probably, if he had the power and took over Demerzel's place, or even the Imperial throne itself, he would feel disappointed because the game would be over. Of course, he might, if he was still alive, begin the subsequent game of keeping power, which might be just as difficult and just as satisfying.
Selden shook his head. It strikes me that no one could possibly want to be emperor.
No sane person would, I agree. But the imperial wish, as it is frequently called, is like a disease that, when caught, drives out sanity. And the closer you get to high office, the more likely you are to catch the disease. With each ensuing promotion,
the disease grows still more acute.
Yes, I can see that.
But it also seems to me that Trantor is so huge a world, so interlocking in its needs and so conflicting in its ambitions, that it makes up the major part of the inability of the Emperor to rule. Why doesn't he just leave Trantor and establish himself on some simpler world?
Doris laughed. You wouldn't ask that if you knew your history. Trantor is the Empire through thousands of years of custom. An Emperor who is not at the Imperial Palace is not the Emperor. He is a place even more than a person.
Selden sank into silence, his face rigid. And after a while, Doris asked,
What's the matter, Harry?
I'm thinking, he said in a muffled voice.
Ever since you told me that hand-on-thigh story, I've had fugitive thoughts that... Now, your remark about the Emperor being a place rather than a person seems to have struck a chord.
What kind of chord?
Selden shook his head. I'm still thinking. I may be all wrong.
His glance at Doris sharpened, his eyes coming into focus. In any case, we ought to go down and have breakfast. We're late, and I don't think Mistress DeSalver is in a good enough humor to have it brought in for us.
You optimist, said Doris. My own feeling is that she's not in a good enough humor to want us to stay, breakfast or not. She wants us out of here.
That may be, but we're paying her.
Yes, but I suspect she hates us enough by now to scorn our credits.
Perhaps her husband will feel a bit more affectionate concerning the rent.
If he has a single word to say, Harry, the only person who would be more surprised than me to hear it would be Mistress DeSalver. Very well, I'm ready.
and they moved down the stairs to the